Welcome. You are listening to BCB Radio on 106.6 FM. I'm your host, Malaika Ahmed, and you are currently listening to The Marrow of Life. Listening to The Marrow of Life, and the reason why I just like to preface this by saying the reason why we are called The Marrow of Life is because this is a radio show about books and its consumption in the modern world and what we think about that, our opinions and our views, and books, literature, stories, they're so fundamental and just it underpins everything culturally within a society, and not even just culturally, everything within a society and what we think and what we do and everything to do with that. So you're listening to The Marrow of Life with my lovely, lovely guests. Would you like to introduce yourselves?
Hi, I'm Isha.
And hello, I'm Iman, and thank you for having us, Malaika, today.
Yeah, so today, specifically, we are going to be talking about how much the consumption of books, literature, has changed throughout the last 200, 100 years, in Britain specifically. So, what I'd just like to make everyone aware of is that when people started reading, not started reading, reading is an ancient pastime, but reading in Britain specifically, it was mainly reserved for upper middle class white men. You'll find in history a lot of women weren't pushed to specifically read. If they did, it would be considered something that, especially within the upper classes, something that a woman had that was sort of extra. A woman would be, she'd be versed in piano, poetry, that sort of thing.
Languages.
Languages. So she was more marriageable, if that makes sense. So it was easier to get her to be married and what family she'd be married to. And the more sort of skills she had, the easier it were to get her into a higher class of a family or stay within the same social class. So that's specifically women, the relationship between women and books. Women weren't obviously allowed to be authors. They weren't allowed to pen books. And it was actually seen as a disgraceful thing for women to have sort of political ideas. So if she was to write a non-fiction book, that would be shamed upon. It was seen as shameful. It was seen as her trying to show herself off, her trying to draw attention to herself. And modesty was obviously a big part of that and the culture of the time. So that's just generally how it was. But specifically to do with books and how people got their hands on them, you know, it wasn't how it is now. Like, you wouldn't go into a shop, grab a paperback. You'd actually get a book and it wouldn't have any binding on it. So it'd just be the pages, itself. And then you'd buy the book and then you'd go home with it and you'd take it to your nearest bookbinder, and there'd be, like, quite a few in every major city, some maybe villages, stuff like that. Wherever there were people who read books, there'd be a bookbinder, you'd get your bookbind. And that's why if you look at old libraries, they're all very uniform, very uniform, very nice looking books, because they got them specifically bind themselves, and that's why they look so nice and uniform, essentially. So what are our opinions about reading in the past century, past two centuries, in fact?
I think that there was a lot of issues with it, but considering how they've evolved, it's kind of good for us. But in the past, it was certainly something that was seen, especially for women, you know, them not being able to write under their own name, or they used to have a men's pen name.
Yeah.
And especially with the, I'm sure it's the Bronte sisters, they had that, and I think it was something that was seen as disgraceful and something that was seen like that because what women were trying to do was, you know, show that they were equally as capable as men, yet that was seen as them trying to be more masculine and them being disgraced for that, being shamed for that. And I think that was something that was really, you know, it was something that was not a good thing. But the fact that that has changed, I think that's something that's really good for us as well.
Yeah. And that has changed because the time period we're specifically talking about, well, at least I'm specifically talking about, is aroundish the 18th century.
Yeah.
And there were quite a lot of female writers, female poets, but they did sometimes have to go under pseudonyms. Don't get me wrong, there were published women under their own names, like Phyllis Wheatley, for example. She was a black woman in America in 1776, 1777, and her poetry was getting published because of the recognition her work achieved. But it's the fact that if a woman wanted to get published, she'd have to be twice that of a man, or even maybe thrice that.
But the difficulties that they had to go through to publish that book as well, the shame they'd get for it, the backlash they'd get for it, that was something to a different extent as well.
Yeah. It's like that for a lot of people, I think, because we haven't experienced that. No one's alive to actually experience
it.
So we're left in the dark, especially because what we have of that time period, of the 18th century, is laws, legislations, documented pieces of...
It's all very minimal. We haven't got a lot. And the fact that, especially things that we're taught in school, the fact that we're only taught about laws in school, the crime and punishment there, about even in English, a subject that's based around reading and writing, we're not taught a lot about our history and how it has changed for us, but it's more about what there is in the present and the writers about the past. It's not what happened in the past for them writers to become writers.
Yeah, definitely. And I think part of that, not knowing how it was socially in the 18th century, specifically for lower class people, for women, is because whatever we do have of that time, it's written by people who are literate, which were usually typically upper class, white men. So we never really truly understand what it was like. Obviously, we do have letters, but... specifically for the lower classes, those letters weren't considered valuable enough to have even been kept if there were letters being exchanged between people in those classes.
Yeah, and even for us now, we cannot get a lot from just letters.
Yeah,
it's one source. The fact we need to have newspapers, we need to have books, we need to have so many different sources for us to be able to find out information about the past. It can't just be done by letters, it can't just be done by a couple of books, and that as well, like you said, Malaika, written mainly by upper class white men.
If someone were in the 18th century to try and understand, you know, the news and things like that, it would be generally through word and mouth, it would be through illustrations and newsletters. The average person wouldn't be able to read. Literacy rates were extremely low. So, like, there were so many layers of disadvantage that the lower classes had at that time, especially to do with literature, to do with the pursuit of knowledge. There were definitely a lot of hindrances there. If you did want to learn how to read and you were one of the lower classes, the way you generally do that is through the church. You'd become a clergyman. Not everyone was able to become a clergyman. And it would just generally be through those sorts of conventions.
I feel like because women weren't like important back then, because they didn't have the...
Weren't considered
right,
important,
they didn't have the right to vote either. It's almost like kept in the shade, like there's not much information about this. Like,
yeah.
There's not much like research or evidence.
I feel like there is a lot of research being done now, definitely. You know, we are trying to get a wider story. There's constantly new studies being made and there's constantly progress being made on...
But it's very slow.
And how much of that evidence is actually factual? How much of it is based on research from books, from, you know, newspapers, articles, letters? How much of it is... opinion and how much of it is it fact, actually?
That's definitely... Because we're viewing history through such a 21st century lens, it can get difficult to actually understand. Is this just how we're perceiving it and our interpretations from 21st century eyes and minds? Or was it actually different back then?
Yeah.
And where it's very difficult for us to step in those shoes and interpret it how it would have been. So, on that note, our first song, actually, is going to be Call Me What You Like by Lovejoy. And I hope you like the song. I quite like the song. Let's see what you think of it. I never
was a fan of the internet. She never felt that safe in her own head. We both hate the news. That for the grace of God goes you. Smiling when I ask if she's bored yet. We wonder if we took it too far. Both taste confused. Think that I'm the only guy she'll see tonight. You can call me what you like, as long as you call me. And you could kiss the skin from my lips if it makes you feel. Myself in your mum's bedroom, fighting with the pink roller blinds. It's on pay-per-view. Just place your bets on who's lost their minds. You take a pirouette under two faces. You sigh with perfect pitch in the time. I'm not made for you, but what else is new? Unless she tells me that it's nothing. Oh, really? Hope it's nothing. You could kiss the skin from my lips if it makes you feel.
Heard Lovejoy's Call Me What You Want. Where did we leave off?
We were going to talk about
the modern days.
Yeah. So how do we feel like reading has changed? Instead of looking at like 200 years ago, 18th century, how much do we think reading has changed in the last sort of few decades, really? Because I think technology has definitely played a large hand in how people are reading. Definitely literacy rates are like an all-time high. I think it's 98%, 99% now. You know, with incredible literacy rates, that does come with a lot of information overload for the 21st century audience, definitely. So what are our opinions and views on that?
So we definitely know one of the like famous brand, not brand, but like famous literacy
source.
Yeah, it's BBC News. So I feel like with technology it does play a big part. Like recently, like maybe a few 20, 30 years back, it was families sitting around the TV and then just like watching the news.
And even before like television was a huge thing, most people would get their news from a newsletter. Yeah. But now we've got that on our phones. And yeah. I think that comes with a lot of responsibility as well, because yeah. we're being exposed to so many different news stories. We're being exposed to so many opinions as well as facts. And I think that's definitely what us as readers in the modern era, that's our main job, is to differentiate fact from opinion, because there's so much misinformation because yeah. of so much information coming in.
There's a lot of propaganda.
Definitely a lot of propaganda. It's just about critically thinking about what you're yeah. reading, what you're consuming, and whether you're actually making your own opinions on something
yeah.
or whether you're just accepting something at like face value because it's what you happen to be reading at the time.
Yeah. I think that's something that's really difficult to differentiate as well, especially for us young audiences and young readers constantly being exposed to news. And it's up to a person on how much they want to avoid yeah. and how much they
actually it's overwhelming
want to, yeah and on how much they want to research and how much they want to get involved.
Definitely. But I feel like for books specifically and literature, It's come a long way, I yeah. think. Look at the fantasy genre.
Yeah.
I feel like there's also now very, like, young authors.
Definitely, yeah. Because if you look at it in the past, fantasy was very, you know,
patriarchal. I don't even think it was a concept back then. And Frankenstein science fiction as well, that wasn't much of a concept. It's especially after authors actually started writing their books about fantasy, about this science fiction genre.
Yeah, I think fantasy is deeply rooted in sort of English folklore and myths and English legends yeah. and stuff like that, yeah. but fantasy, in essence, is creating a new world, a world... It's all about that world building. It's about creating a way to escape, not yeah. even just escape, but just
like different. Your imagination just
yeah, up. It's like looking into someone's mind, essentially.
Yeah.
And if you look at in the past, you've seen a lot of fantasy, which is still very patriarchal, mm-hmm. still very male dominated. But I think you're seeing the archetype of what fantasy is slowly being changed, and you do see that throughout history. You see archetypes change. You see the same story being told in different ways, essentially, yeah. because as humans, we've just run out of stories to tell. We've told. That's why you keep seeing remakes of the same movie. We've told everything. We're finding something again, or we're not. Like,
it's how much detail you add into that, and how much detail yeah. is changed and swapped. Yeah.
Yeah. I would just like to introduce a quote by Marie Antoinette. Nothing is new except what has been forgotten. And I think it's a very impactful quote, because there is nothing new in the world. Everything is just what has been forgotten and then reclaimed, forgotten and yeah. then reclaimed, and not even reclaimed, but just re-envisioned. There yeah. is no original thought anymore. There is no original experience. The human experience in general is definitely individual, but we need to accept that we have collective experiences, and it's okay to experience things collectively.
Yeah.
Because in this individualistic society that we exist in now, it's all about how...
Yourself.
Yeah. And you only place value in something if it's only yourself that's doing it.
Yeah.
And I think that's definitely very detrimental, because then you've got all these stories that have been told but need to keep on being told as well. Yeah. And re-envisioned in 21st century lights, like Samantha Shannon, she's an incredible fantasy author. She's taken the George and the Dragon, that basic archetype. It's essentially the fantasy story that's originally a religious story but has been changed and moulded over the years. And in her story, The Priory of the Orange Tree, it's definitely, she's retold it in a feminist light. I think that's the only true feminist fantasy book that I've ever read where I feel as though it's not completely patriarchal.
Yeah.
Because I definitely, like, don't get me started on A Court of Thorns and Roses, because that is not, we don't talk about it. But in The Priory of the Orange Tree, it was truly an incredible book. The world building in there was astounding. It was astounding. And it's 800 pages long. But
I'm going to have to read that now.
You're going to have to read it, because all the great fantasy books have incredible world building, and that's at the heart of all fantasy.
Yeah, I think that's a really important aspect in a book. You know, when you're reading like two different types, not two different types, but like, say you're reading two fantasies book, the fact that both of them have the same story, but how they're being described is so much, and from which point of view they are as well, that really impacts on what the fantasy is. And that's how it's been developed through the years as well. The fact that in the past it used to be more about, you know, like you said, Malaika, not from a feminist point of view, not from, you know, not generally described for a 21st audience. And, well, it was expected, to where it is now. It's such a big development.
Definitely. And I think all books are windows into the time period that they were written in.
Yeah.
So if you take Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, for example, that's the story of Frankenstein, the scientist who's created life, something that's so inorganic, so ungodly, to a 19th century audience, definitely, and to just any audience, to be honest. Creating new life from human hands is just something that's extremely taboo, and was extremely taboo in that instance. And I think it's definitely that. Some ideas, some ideologies definitely stick within a society.
Yeah.
And I think that's definitely one of them. Because in that century, you had the development of x-rays, the development of cameras, more people were using them. You had people doing these massive scientific experiments, and people were just completely, like, they felt as though their religion was being under attack. The thing that underpinned everything they did and everything in society at the time, they felt like that was being attacked.
Yeah.
And I think we can definitely draw parallels within modern day reading and modern day books and modern day ideologies. Like, let's take stem cell research, for example. The 14-day law, where stem cells are essentially the cells that grow in the embryo, what grows in the embryo, and they have the ability to
differentiate
and turn into whatever cell they need to be. So let's say there's a stem cell, so that's just a basic average cell, then it can turn into a blood cell, and it can turn into a nerve cell, and whatever it may be
that the body needs,
yes. And it can grow into tissue, so human skin tissue, any sort of tissue. It can grow into a liver, but the ability to clone a human being with stem cells is what is very concerning, and what a lot of people are, what a lot of news articles especially are concerned about when discussing stem cell research. So it's definitely something that's remained constant throughout society between that time and now. That constant change, that feeling as though people's traditional values are being threatened.
Is it ethical views?
Yeah, ethical views as well, moral views as well. All that sort of comes and knits together.
Yeah.
And I find it especially incredible how books are able to conceptualise that, because as much as we've changed in the past century, decades, even with technology, humans are always humans.
Yeah.
We always have those ideas, those beliefs. We're always going to hold what we hold dear to ourselves.
Yeah.
And that might change depending on which culture you look at, depending on which time period you look at, but it's always constant.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and I think that's something that's incredibly beautiful. But specifically books within the last few centuries.
This idea just came into my mind now, but the fact that, you know, how you said Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, that was something that, you know, scientists, that's something that you become in the future when you're, like, you know, generally older and more have been through a lot of education. But the fact that younger audiences now, you know, kids have access to reading books that involve these aspects of science fiction, of different genres that you know, that are careers, that may be careers in the future of their life. It's something that's really I think that has also been something that has developed books and has developed reading into what it is now.
Yeah.
The fact that it's not only for white upper class, generally white upper class men, but it's something that even kids can read now. Forget even us, younger siblings, younger people can read, and it's just something that's really it's what has developed into the 21st century.
Yeah. I feel like the main difference between reading in the past and reading now is not what we're reading about. It's not what's going on, because, you know, people, there's always a moral panic going on in every century, and we're going through another one now, but it's always happened. Yeah. It's always happening. And it hasn't changed. Yeah. That hasn't changed itself. I think what's really changed about reading, is about literature, reads. Is who reads and the accessibility behind it.
Yeah, definitely.
And how accessible reading is, specifically like literacy. Mm-hmm. Because yeah. stories have always been told. They're always going to be told for as long as humans walk this earth. We will hold stories near and dear to our hearts because that's how we communicate. Yeah. Think about it. Why is almost every religious book not just a set of laws? Why is it an entire narrative? It's because that's what touches human souls.
Yeah.
And that's... It's beautiful. Yeah. It really is beautiful. So, so that's it for today. That's our show. We've discussed reading within the last 200 years. We've discussed reading... right now, and we've discussed the eternal human experience.
Yeah,
and that's lovely, isn't it?
Yeah,
yeah. So now we're gonna listen to a little bit of Lana Del Rey, "Summertime Sadness." Love it, breathe it, ingest it into your soul. but first, goodbye.
Bye. Thank you for having us, Malaika.
Yeah, it's been lovely having you, Isha and Aman. But now, Lana Del Rey.
Yeah.
Kiss me hard before you go. Summertime sadness. I just wanted you to know that baby, you're the best. I got my red dress on tonight.